You're listening to Audio Journal. Up next are articles and stories from Reader's Digest. This program is funded in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. My name is Holly Miller, and I'm your volunteer reader. I was a volunteer for Audio Journal when I lived in Massachusetts. I've since moved back to my home state of Texas, but I'm thrilled that I can continue volunteering for Audio Journal by recording this program remotely. I'll begin my program today with an article from RD.com, 20 Weird and Amazing Things That Only Happen in the Summer, by Lisa Marie Canklin. Summer means the days are longer, the ice cream melts faster, and somehow you're hungry again just 20 minutes after lunch. But beyond beach trips and pool days, there are plenty of surprising summer facts hiding beneath all that sunshine. That's why we're sharing summer facts you probably didn't know, some that will make you laugh, and a few that might finally explain things you've been blaming yourself for years. Whether you're a parent looking for fun tidbits to share on a road trip, or a graduate student soaking up one last carefree season before the next chapter begins, these facts about summer are as relatable as they are fascinating. Summertime sadness is real. Seasonal affective disorder, or SAD, has two seasons, winter and summer. More people suffer from winter sad than summer sad, and the causes and symptoms are generally the opposite. For example, research points to too much sun causing an overdose of vitamin D in the summer versus too little in the winter. And instead of overeating with winter sad, summer sad sufferers actually experience a loss of appetite. Anxiety and poor body image, along with comparing yourself to your friend's social media highlights, are also contributing factors. Sleep patterns are too. With summer sad, insomnia keeps you up, causing irritability and moodiness. More babies are born in the summer. Summer is peak baby season in the United States, with July, August, and September constantly ranking among the busiest birth months of the year. In fact, September is often one of the most popular months for birthdays, making late summer a time when hospitals welcome a surge of new arrivals. You're more likely to get a UTI in the summer. If you're under 40 and female, your chances of getting a urinary tract infection, or UTI, in the summer are fairly high, according to a study published in the Open Forum of Infectious Disease online. In fact, hospitalization for a UTI spikes for this age group in the summer months. Summer heat and humidity provide the perfect breeding ground for bacteria to hang out in your urinary tract. And when that happens, you'll know it. It will burn when you pee, and you'll feel like you have to go every 5 minutes. Wearing a damp swimsuit all day, not drinking enough water, or holding on to your pee because you just can't walk to the beach porta potty are all no-nos. The Eiffel Tower gets taller in the summer. Who would have thought that one of the most interesting fun facts about summer would revolve around the Eiffel Tower? The tower gains about 6 inches in height during the warmer summer months. The famous landmark is mainly constructed of metal, which expands in heat. In addition, the top of the tower may shift away from the sun by as much as 7 inches due to thermal expansion on the side facing the sun. Summer is peak season for sea turtles. Sea turtle walks are a popular event on Florida beaches in June and July, when huge mama turtles weighing in at around 200 to 250 pounds come ashore to lay their eggs. The tiny and adorable sea turtles hatch, but they don't just make a run for the water. Turtles wait until the sand cools, which is usually at night, and begin their journey to the water. If you're lucky enough to see them at night, don't shine any light on them. It could really interfere with their sense of direction and get them off course. More divorces happen in the summer. According to research from the University of Washington, more parents divorce in March and August than any other months. The ever-present family activity calendar likely prompts parents to file, After all, who wants to ruin the winter holiday or summer vacation with a divorce and custody issues? The late summer filings coincide with the upcoming school year. Summer brings more thunderstorms in certain areas. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, National Weather Service, if you live in the lower Midwest and Southeast, you're going to get more rain in the summer. These areas are more humid, and high humidity and warm temperature are a ripe formula for thunderstorms. It seems summer air can hold a lot more water vapor than colder air in the cooler months. And once those clouds can't hold anymore, they let it go, and boom, you have a summer thunderstorm. Summer is Hollywood's blockbuster season. Summer is the busiest time of year for major theatrical releases. The season kicks off in early May and continues through August, with studios scheduling their biggest and most expensive films. Think major superhero movies, epic sci-fi adventures, and animated features, all to take advantage of kids being on summer break. The hottest part of summer has a name. It's called Dog Days of Summer, July 3rd through August 11th, and has nothing to do with our beloved furry companions. It actually has to do with an astrological event. According to National Geographic, the dog star Sirius appears to rise just before the sun in late July. The Greek and Romans referred to these as the hottest times of the year. The Egyptians referred to Sirius as the Nile star, and when they saw it rising before dawn, they knew the Nile would flood its banks and make their ground more fertile. Summer months are deemed hot dog season. Summer is hot dog season for a few reasons. It's the favored portable food when you're camping, hanging out at the ballpark, or hosting a barbecue. Americans eat an estimated 20 billion hot dogs from Memorial Day to Labor Day. We might need a little more mustard, because that equates to 70 hot dogs per person annually. Summer features dazzling meteor showers. The Perseid meteor shower in August is an annual favorite of amateur stargazers. During this time, Earth passes through debris left by Comet 109P Swift Tuttle, which last passed near Earth in 1992. Think of them as shooting stars. The Perseids are active from July 17th to August 24th, but according to the American Meteor Society, the shower reaches its peak on August 12th or 13th, depending on the year. Death rates increase in the summer. Don't panic if you end up in the ER this summer. But a report published in the Annals of Internal Medicine found the most dangerous time to go to the hospital is July, especially if it's a teaching hospital where new doctors are trained. July is the month seasoned medical students leave the hospital and new med students arrive. Death rates increase between 8% to 24% in July. You're more likely to get burned in the summer. It doesn't matter if you're 10 or 48. Waving a sparkler on the 4th of July is a time-honored tradition we all love. Unfortunately, the United States Consumer Product Safety Commission Fireworks Information Center says these sparklers can heat up to 2,000 degrees. That's enough to melt some metals and your skin. Yikes! Summer babies have more mood swings. A European College of Neuropsychopharmacology study revealed that babies born during the summer are more prone to mood swings, and babies born in cooler months are more, pardon the pun, chill. Scientists in the study aren't exactly sure why this happens, but neurotransmitters such as dopamine and serotonin may be influenced by the season in which you're born. Just don't let the study dictate your mood. Summer heat can affect diabetes management. Injection sites change in the summer due to excessive heat. When it's hot, your blood vessels open up more, so insulin can get into your system faster after you take it. This puts you at risk for low blood sugar. If this happens, get inside and cool off a few minutes before doing the injection. And remember to keep your insulin at a temperature below 86 degrees. Some countries get 24 hours of sun in the summer. The midnight sun, visible sun for 24 hours, is a natural phenomenon that occurs around the summer solstice each year. and lasts for several weeks. Northern lands, including Canada, Iceland, Sweden, Finland, Norway, Russia, and Alaska, all benefit. In Burrow, Alaska, the sun doesn't set for 2.5 months. Goats climb more in the summer. Every June, goats climb 30 feet or more of the thorny and gnarly argan trees of southwest Morocco to get a taste of the tree's fruit, which looks like a shriveled up apple. It's a scenario that seems like only kids could imagine, but these goats were made for climbing trees. They have two-toed hooves, which spread out to give them balance and leverage. The soft soles of the goat's hooves help them grab onto the bark, and their dew claws give them the ability to pull themselves up branches. Fireflies have an annual meet and mate every summer. The Great Smoky Mountain National Park, which spans across the borders of Tennessee and North Carolina, hosts a massive meet and mate night for fireflies. These synchronous fireflies show up in the thousands every summer for 2 weeks of synchronized blinking to attract mates. But they have to act fast. Even though the larva can take up to 2 years to mature, once born, fireflies live for only about 21 days. Summer is one of the best seasons for whale watching. Fall in New England may be picturesque with brilliant foliage, but you might want to head there in the summer to see the whales. That's when they swim into the warm waters for their annual nutrient-enriched feeding frenzy of krill, herring, mackerel, and other schooling fish. The most common sightseeings include the humpback, finback, and minks. Once the water starts to cool, they head to warmer waters to mate and breed. And finally, you'll see more bears fishing in the summer. Summertime in Alaska brings out four-legged fishermen, as wild bears gather around streams and falls to fish for sockeye salmon. Thousands upon thousands of salmon swim together upstream, but many don't get a chance to spawn, since the bears are waiting to grab them for lunch. It's not unusual for a bear to nab hundreds of salmon each day during spawning season. Also from RD.com, What is the 4th of July, and why do we celebrate it? By Kelly Kuhn. What is the 4th of July? Here's your complete guide to the 4th of July and why we celebrate it. July 4th, also known as Independence Day, is an annual American holiday that falls on, you guessed it, the 4th of July. While you're thinking of fun 4th of July ideas for this year's celebration, you may wonder about the 4th of July's history. Why do we celebrate it each year? Well, don't worry. We're breaking it down for you with this 4th of July guide. What is the 4th of July? Wondering why we celebrate the 4th of July? Well, the day is very significant in American history. It marks the day the Declaration of Independence was adopted, July 4, 1776, and the United States officially became its own nation. American citizens celebrate America's birthday with festivals, parades, fireworks, barbecue, and other festive activities. Which country did we declare our independence from? America declared its independence from Great Britain. In order to fully understand the significance of Independence Day and what happened in 1776, we need to go back in history a bit, before America was its own country. It was composed of 13 colonies established by the Brits: New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Delaware, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. The first colony was settled in Jamestown, Virginia, in 1607. European countries, especially Great Britain, continued to colonize America through the 17th century and a good portion of the 18th century. By 1775, an estimated 2.5 million settlers lived in the 13 colonies. What led the colonists to seek independence? Tension started brewing when Great Britain passed legislation that gave it more control within the colonies, especially when it came to taxing the colonists. The crown was in debt after the French and Indian War, so it started taxing the American colonies to boost revenue. The passage of legislation like the Stamp Act in March 1765, the Townshend Act in June and July of 1767, and the Tea Act of 1773 forced colonists to pay more money to Great Britain, even though the colonies didn't have a say in the Crown's policies. This became known as taxation without representation, a concept that was a heated pillar in the American Revolution. What really happened on July 4, 1776? Fast forward to June 1776 Continental Congress meeting in Philadelphia. Here, Virginia statesman Richard Henry Lee proposed a motion for the colonies to declare independence from Britain. A committee was formed to draft an official independence document, which became known as the Declaration of Independence. On July 2, 1776, Lee's motion for independence was approved. 2 days later, on July 4, 1776, the Declaration of Independence was officially adopted, and America became a free nation. After declaring independence, America continued to fight in the Revolutionary War and officially defeated Great Britain in September 1783. What interesting 4th of July facts should Americans know? The history of the 4th of July is fascinating, but there are other fascinating 4th of July facts every American should know. Here are 6 of the most notable. Some colonists celebrated Independence Day during the summer of 1776 by putting on mock funerals for King George III of England, symbolizing the death of the Crown's rule on America. The first annual commemoration of Independence Day happened on July 4, 1777 in Philadelphia. John Adams, a founding father and the second president of the United States, strongly believed Independence Day should be celebrated on July 2nd. He even refused to attend the 4th of July events because he felt so strongly about July 2nd being the correct date. Adams and Thomas Jefferson, a fellow founding father, both died on July 4, 1826. James Monroe, another U.S. president, also died on July 4th, but he passed in 1831. Thomas Jefferson was the first president to celebrate Independence Day at the White House in 1801. The celebration featured horse races, parades, food, and drinks, similar to the 4th of July celebrations we see today. And finally, although the 4th of July has been celebrated each year since 1776, it didn't become a federal holiday until 1870, and it didn't become a paid holiday for federal employees until 1941. From the America 250 section, My Wish for America, a special collaboration from the New York Historical, curated by Joni L. Rolina. On our country's 250th birthday, imagine a big cake with millions of candles, each representing a wish. Now imagine that one of those candles is yours. What's your wish for America? The New York Historical asked that all-important question, and more than 10,000 people in all 50 states and Washington, D.C. shared their best thoughts for our nation's future. To read more and share your own, visit onour250th.org. Comments about inspiration. From Tina in Idaho, my wish for America the Beautiful is to forever stand as the shining light on a hill. Honesty plus opportunity plus hard work equals success. Our nation still provides us with everything we need when we try. From Alexis in South Carolina, gratitude. America, thank you for the freedom to live and love in the beautiful land we call home. From Rocky in New York, thank you, America, for all the glorious songs and sights and sounds. Keep making your music. Teach the children. Stay strong. Comments about patriotism. From Val in California, for Americans to learn to love this beautiful nation, even if you don't like the guy or gal in charge. For all, whether Democrats or Republicans, to come together as one and be Americans first before we are anything else. From Stephanie in Tennessee, happy 250th birthday, America. I wish for patriotism to increase among young people. I wish for an end to poverty and homelessness. Comments on community from Morgan in Alaska. I wish that we could return to celebrating learning and knowledge of supporting our libraries and museums. I wish that we could return to making communities in the acceptance of others, even if they are different. From Wellesley in Illinois. On this, America's quarter millennium anniversary, I wish the American people more social interaction with our neighbors and countrymen, while cutting down dramatically on social media. On the subject of democracy, from Kristen in Michigan, a thriving democracy, healthy public debate, strong and independent press, and the relentless pursuit of the enduring ideals of liberty, justice, and equality for all. May we keep working together to make the dream real and honor our shared humanity. From Bonnie in Arkansas, I pray for the return of the desires of our forefathers and create their intention to create one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. From Gary in Connecticut, I wish for democracy to shine bright in my country. I plan to be part of the solution. On service, from Jennifer in Washington, D.C., I hope that we will restore the faith in what used to be known as public service. That is, elected representatives serving all the people. Not self-service, not for personal financial gain or power, but for the benefit of the people. From Sherry in Florida, the problems we currently face can only be resolved if we work together. The people of America have always joined together to resolve conflict. Let's do it now. On the subject of hope, from Kara in Maryland, that we are actively pursuing big, bold, aspirational futures that are worthy of our children and their children and the generations to come. On the subject of equality, from Barbara in Virginia, my hope is for an America where everyone is respected for their talents, gifts, and intelligence, where we proudly support the Constitution of the United States as the best example of democracy, a diverse, equitable, and inclusive country. From Evie in Ohio, for women to be paid equally. From Ellen in Texas, I wish for world peace, kindness, and serenity for all. On the subject of togetherness, from Tom in Pennsylvania, my wish for America is for everyone to respect and appreciate our differences, to unite us and not divide us. We are stronger together. Let us work together for the common good of all. From Melly in Utah, I love the idea of a huge neighborhood potluck representing all culinary traditions and backgrounds that represent the great American melting pot. From Chris in New Hampshire, I hope that we can become more accepting of everyone's differences and make room for everyone to be safe and accepted. And finally, on the subject of Onward, from Melanie in Maine, the past merely informs our future, which is destined to be great if we can look courageously forward, acknowledging the power that comes from our diversity and differences. And finally, from Michelle in New Jersey, happy 250th birthday, America, land that I love, the best is yet to come. All in a day's work. From Dennis Byron. When a new restaurant opened nearby, my wife and I made sure to get a table on opening night. It was our server's first time working at a restaurant, and she was bubbling over with enthusiasm. Case in point, I asked, "What is the soup du jour?" Beaming with the pride of one who has found her calling, she answered, "Oh, that's the soup of the day." From overheardintheoffice.com, attorney on phone. "Hi, sweetie, I'm going to come pick you up after school tomorrow to take you to your appointment." "Well, Mommy was going to, but she's too important to leave her office, and I'm not that important, so I can leave." from Forbes.com. In 1983, Freddie Heineken, the owner of the eponymous Heineken Brewery, was kidnapped and held for ransom for weeks. As awful as it was, Heineken never lost his sense of humor. After finally being released, he told a friend, "They tortured me. They made me drink Carlsberg." From Nicole Thurman on X, people who live alone should get one practice conversation before they have to speak out loud for the first time of the day. From Pat Sitchko, as a single mother, I found that getting the kids off to school and then driving 45 minutes to work was a struggle. Luckily, my boss was very forgiving. In fact, one day he greeted me with a cheerful smile, exclaiming, "Today's the earliest you've been late all week." From Steve Whitman, with seconds to go and the score tied, I called a timeout and drew up a play on a small whiteboard for the high school basketball team I coached. "Got it?" I asked the players. They did. We put our hands in the middle and shouted our team cheer, and they ran back onto the floor. I had tremendous confidence, until one player turned back to me and said, "Were we the X's or the O's?" From NurseBuff.com, these all too real excerpts from medical transcripts beg the question, how does anyone get out of the hospital alive? The baby was delivered, the cord clamped and cut, and handed to the pediatrician, who breathed and cried immediately. Patient was present when suppository was inserted. Bleeding began in the rectal area and continued all the way to Los Angeles. The patient's past medical history has been remarkably insignificant, with only a 40-pound weight gain in the past 3 days. And finally, social history reveals this one-year-old patient does not smoke or drink and is presently unemployed. This job is a joke. Three comedians describe their earliest gigs. From Chris Rock, "I used to work at McDonald's making minimum wage. You know what that means when someone pays you minimum wage? You know your first boss was trying to say, 'Hey, if I could pay you less, I would, but it's against the law.'" From Michelle Wolf, "I got fired from my last job. It was fair. I had stopped working. When they fired me, they called me into HR and they were like, 'Michelle, it seems like you're just not doing your job.' And I was like, 'Yeah, but for like 9 months. So I think two of us haven't been doing our jobs.'" And finally, from Zach Galifianakis, "I called a temp agency once. They were like, 'Do you have any phone skills?' I was like, 'I called you, didn't I?'" From Rob Eastway, in the book Much Ado About Numbers, Shakespeare mentioned the number 2 nearly 700 times in his plays, but he sometimes called it by another name, twain, an old English word for two. The bard used twain 47 times, including in this line from one of his famous tragedies, "O Hamlet, thou hast cleft my heart in twain." The word largely died out over the next 300 years. Though in 19th century Mississippi, boatmen, measuring the river depth, would shout a warning if the river was shallower than 2 fathoms, or 12 feet. The cry, "Mark Twain." When Samuel Clemens was looking for a pseudonym, he decided to borrow this boating call. Glad to hear it. Stories to make your day. A purposeful life. When a dolphin was trapped in a creek in Clearwater, Florida for 3 weeks, the Clearwater Marine Aquarium, or CMA, decided to help it back to the open seas for its own safety. But that wouldn't be easy. The only way out was through a small opening under a bridge, a path the dolphin seemed to loathe to take. To help coax it out, 28 biologists from CMA and elsewhere entered the water to form a human chain. They slowly moved toward the lost dolphin. The dolphin, wanting nothing to do with the humans, escaped through the passage and out into Tampa Bay. CMA's Brittany Baldricka said in a statement that the idea wasn't to scare the dolphin, but rather to give it the option to swim through the bridge on its own. And have a seat. The sight of a woman sitting on the ground at a Denver bus stop spurred James Warren to concoct a solution. Build benches so weary commuters could wait for their bus in dignity. Warren, 29, isn't a carpenter. He's a consultant for the Colorado Workforce Development Council. But using the Just Wing It method of bench building, and without waiting for the city's permission, he has crafted 8 benches for local bus stops, all inscribed with the message, "Be kind." The city is now on board, as are others who also want to build benches. "That's the idea," Warren told the Washington Post. "Let's just all help our neighbors." Did you know that there are many ways to listen to Audio Journal broadcasts? You can listen to our live stream from your computer or tablet simply by going to our website at audiojournal.org. With a Wi-Fi connection, Audio Journal can also be accessed through your smart speaker. Simply say, "Alexa, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn." Or, "Hey Google, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn." You can also listen using a landline phone. For phone access, call Zeno Media at 1-712-770-1043. We also provide special receivers tuned to Audio Journal's frequency. Need one? Give us a call at 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.org for more information. You can also listen through local cable TV stations. Check our list to find your town by going to audiojournal.org/ways-2-listen. Oh no! Did you miss your favorite program? Not a problem. Look for archives on our website or the Audio Journal iPhone app at audiojournal.org/podcast-archive. Audio Journal is located at 799 West Boylston Street in Worcester. You can reach us at 508-797-1117 or at info@audiojournal.org. Health. Our data, ourselves. Wearable trackers from smartwatches to rings can give you stats on everything from your daily step count to minutes of REM sleep. But does more information lead to better health? By Beth Winehouse. Years ago, I read the book Bridget Jones's Diary by Helen Fielding about a single woman in London looking for love. And I was struck by the fact that, while there was a lot of text devoted to her quest for romance, Bridget often started her diary entries by detailing personal metrics. She listed things like how much she weighed, how many cigarettes she'd smoked that day, how much alcohol she'd had to drink, and the number of calories she consumed. At the time, that seemed to me like such a stressful and somewhat obsessive way to keep a record of your life. Fast forward to today. I wake up and check my wearable tracker to see how many hours I've slept. Then I input what I ate for breakfast so I can monitor my calorie intake. My tracker also counts my steps, and I aim for at least 10,000 each day. And every once in a while, just because the information is available, I monitor my heart rate during exercise and at rest, and my blood oxygen level. If I wanted, I could also keep an eye on a lot more, such as how much water I'm drinking each day and my stress level at any point in time. And I'm not alone. It's estimated that more than 1 in 5 American adults now use a wearable biotracker of some kind, including watches, rings, patches, earbuds, clip-on devices, and smart clothing. Whether someone's trying to lose weight, get more fit, sleep better, or monitor a chronic medical condition like high blood pressure or diabetes, there is a wearable device that can offer relevant information. But there are also questions about whether having access to all this information is actually making us fitter and healthier, and whether there's a danger of too much information being potentially harmful. Keeping people on track. As with a lot of new technology, think AI for example, there are good uses and some not so good uses that come with the hardware. When utilized appropriately, these products can indeed help people manage medical conditions or just become more aware of their health and fitness. Overall, I find the use of health and fitness trackers to be positive, says Seth Creasy, PhD, a metabolism and obesity researcher at the University of Colorado's Ann Schultz Medical Campus. Trackers help individuals monitor their behavior or health, which can help bring awareness to areas of health that need to be improved. Trackers can also help with motivation and goal setting. For instance, if you're aiming to walk at least 10,000 steps a day and you look at your tracker and you see you've only walked 8,000 steps, it might inspire you to go out and walk 2,000 more. Trackers may also nudge people toward their goals by offering reminders or digital incentives in the form of badges, in-app competitions with friends or others, or the quest to close the rings on Apple Watches by meeting daily goals. Many researchers are looking to quantify just how effective trackers are in helping people monitor their health and improve their diet and fitness. While there are a few long-term studies that offer definitive data, a literature review published in the Lancet Digital Health Journal found that across short-term studies of almost 164,000 participants, the use of an activity tracker improved physical activity by an average of 1,800 extra steps and about 40 minutes more walking each day, which is a significant change. In addition to trackers for logging data tied to diet and fitness goals, many people have health wearables recommended by their doctors to help manage chronic conditions such as high blood pressure and diabetes. For example, continuous blood sugar monitors in the form of skin patches mean that people don't have to prick their fingers to monitor glucose levels. The monitors provide nearly constant information, usually delivered to a phone app. These devices will never replace the medical expertise of a physician or medical professional, says Creasy, but they do provide useful information outside of those visits. He adds that even people without chronic conditions can benefit. For example, an individual may have normal blood pressure at their annual physical, but when they measure it daily at work or at home, they notice it tends to be higher. This may be something to discuss with a physician, and without using the tracker, they wouldn't be aware of it. The downsides. But while there are undeniably many benefits to using wellness devices, studies have pointed to a number of potential hazards as well. The first issue has to do with accuracy and consistency. The trackers can be accurate for certain metrics like steps, time in bed, and heart rate, says Creasy. However, they aren't able to measure these things accurately all the time. Creasy says he has used the devices in several research studies and has seen numerous occasions where the data says one thing, but the person tells another story. He explains that sometimes, for example, wearables struggle to detect the difference between sleeping time and sedentary behavior. That's a problem, he says, since sedentary time is typically thought of as a negative health behavior and sleeping is a positive one. While tracker technology continues to improve, there is always a margin for error in the data. Another problem is how people understand and use the data that's provided. Information viewed in isolation doesn't provide the complete picture, says Jessica Matthews, a doctor of behavioral health and a professor of integrated wellness in the College of Health Sciences at Point Loma Nazarene University in San Diego. What's important is that one piece of information be used as part of a greater whole. That includes objective data like blood pressure readings and glucose monitor readings. With medical devices especially, experts recommend that people discuss their use and information with a health professional. The psychological toll. Perhaps the biggest potential problem with using these products is how they can affect the psychological health of those who are susceptible. Experts explain there's a tendency for some people to fixate on the information their tracker provides and to become overly reliant on it. And for perfectionists, failing to meet their fitness or sleep goals can cause feelings of stress or failure. Monitoring calories consumed and calories expended can help some people lose weight, but others may become discouraged and give up the effort if the data they're seeing isn't what they were hoping for. And for others, an ongoing stream of information may exacerbate eating disorders by encouraging a constant fixation on diet and calories. Similarly, says Matthews, for some people, exercise can become compulsive in a very unhappy way. Is it great to track steps? Not for that person. While trackers can deliver an impressive amount of information, more is not necessarily better for anyone. That's especially true for people who are prone to experiencing a physical symptom and then becoming obsessed with it. Imagine if you have a technology that allows you to do that throughout the day, says Matthews. You notice that your heart rate is higher than it was 10 minutes ago. Now it's slower. It can open the door to a kind of neurotic behavior. For these people, more information can be a source of physiological as well as psychological stress. Phil Lane, MSW, a psychotherapist in private practice in Pennington, New Jersey, recommends that people who have been diagnosed with an anxiety disorder or who are prone to feeling anxious, especially over health issues, be aware that using trackers might make matters worse. He recommends checking with a therapist or mental health clinician about possible drawbacks before deciding to use one. Signs of overtracking. The many kinds of activity monitors meant to give us more information about our bodies can conversely get in the way and distance us from ourselves. Experts cite a tendency for people to rely on the information from the device rather than tune into what they're feeling. For example, looking at a tracker to see how well you slept rather than noticing how rested you feel. I use them myself, and I recommend them in my practice, says Haley Perlis, PhD, a sport and performance psychology expert. But I think when we become too attached, too reliant, we lose self-reflection. We need to assess how we're feeling instead of relying on a device. Some signs of over-reliance, says Perlis, are when people can't leave the house without the device or believe their workout or steps don't count because they aren't wearing a tracker. And if someone asks you how your workout is and you say, "I don't know, I have to look at my tracker," that's a sign you may need to put it down. It's a red flag if you're looking at the numbers for an unnecessary amount of time, adds Lane. That's not a helpful behavior, and it can get in the way of living your life. Do you need a wearable to tell you if you're feeling stressed? I would say no. If you're having a panic attack, you don't need a device to tell you you're having a panic attack. If you're using technology, be very aware of your relationship to it, recommends Lane. The human brain likes measurements, she says. There are psychological draws to information like this, but it's not always healthy, adds Matthews. Trackers provide an opportunity for people to get greater insights about their health and fitness, but they don't tell the whole story. And they shouldn't come at the expense of listening to your body. If we're only worried about the data, we might actually miss the most important data of all. I plan to take all this advice to heart and be less like Bridget Jones. I'm not going to give up my health monitor, but I'll start using it differently. Instead of consulting the tracker in the morning to see how many hours I've slept, I'll ask myself how rested I feel. And while I want to continue using it to encourage me to get my 10,000 daily steps, I'll take breaks from it so I can tune into my body, because we're all so much more than a set of numbers and data. Here are some tips for tracking smart. Used correctly, health monitors help people not only achieve their goals, but also set goals, says Perlis. You can see what you've been doing, know your baseline, and see if you can challenge yourself and increase it. And they give you real information to make sure those goals are appropriate. They're great for accountability, education, and giving us information. And I think they're fun, which is a good motivator. Here's how to get the most out of your device. Take it one goal at a time. Be clear on what your goal is, says Matthews. Today's technology can monitor so many different things that the possibilities can be overwhelming. Sleep, stress, exercise, diet, pick one to start. Choose the product that fits your needs. Online reviews can help you select a reliable device that's within your budget and measure what's most meaningful to you. If improving your sleep is your most important goal, look for a tracker that measures sleep accurately and offers lots of information around that specific topic. And if your main goal is to increase your step count, then a simple pedometer may be all you need, says Matthews. You can buy one for a few dollars, and there have been studies that show they're actually quite accurate. Have a plan for how to use the information. Just capturing your data won't make you healthier. These devices provide information, but unless you take action and change some habits, there won't be any benefit. Most wearables link to health and fitness apps that can suggest actions based on the data that's gathered. For instance, if you sit at a desk all day, the app can trigger reminders to get up and move every half hour or so. If the tracker indicates you're not sleeping as long or as soundly as you optimally should be, the app can offer tips on how to improve that. If the tracker detects that you're stressed, the app may offer breathing exercises or guided meditation sessions to help. And if you want to start a new exercise routine, the app can help you choose one that meets your fitness level. Be aware of your body signals. Don't ignore what your body is telling you. You don't want to have the information from a tracker overtake or hijack your awareness, says Matthews. Ask yourself, how am I feeling today? And do I feel rested? The body knows when it's tired. Keep the information in perspective. Recognize that one piece of information doesn't tell the complete picture. Many of the things that trackers measure go through normal fluctuations throughout the day. Blood pressure increases with activity. Blood sugar varies depending on what we eat. Heart rate, stress level, and fatigue also vary. You may need to discuss the data from your device with your healthcare provider to understand what it means. Take periodic breaks. I would challenge people who are using a fitness tracker all the time to go out and move their bodies without it for a day or a week, says Perlis. Sleep for a week without looking at the data. It's good for self-reflection and a good tune-up for yourself. Art of Living. Food, facts, and fun. There's more to s'mores. Gather round the fire and we'll tell you, by Emily Tyra. The gooey goodness at the heart of s'mores goes back to the summer of 1892, that is. That year, roasting marshmallows around a campfire became all the rage in the seaside towns, according to reports published in New York World and the Chicago Daily Tribune. Marshmallow roasts are the newest thing, a trend spotter wrote in a dispatch from the New Jersey shore that August. One buys 2 or 3 pounds of marshmallows, invites a half dozen friends to build a small fire on an unfrequented spot on the beach, away from crowds unfamiliar with so refined a species of entertainment. The writer noted that the fad was an excellent medium for flirtation, appropriately exhibited by nibbling the marshmallows of each other's sticks. Graham crackers and chocolate bars soon followed. The graham crackers' inventor, Presbyterian minister Sylvester Graham, died in 1851, so he never saw his namesake snack become a commercial success. By the turn of the century, bakers were selling their own sweeter versions, and in 1900, Hershey's released its famed milk chocolate bars, becoming a household name. Who was the first to combine all three components? The Girl Scouts, experts in both campfires and cookies. Their 1927 tome, Tramping and Trailing with the Girl Scouts, features sing-alongs and survival skills, including an all-important lesson on how to toast two marshmallows over the coals to a crispy, gooey state, and then place them inside a graham cracker and chocolate bar sandwich. Though it tastes like some more, one is really enough. Even gave the treat its name. But in truth, one some more will never be enough, especially if its ongoing popularity is any indication. An oven-baked riff on the s'more, developed by food writer Nia Arnson and viewed 8 million times on TikTok, starts with the requisite recipe, but adds a scoop of chocolate chip cookie dough, mounded and baked on top, transforming it into a cookie marvel. Meanwhile, Pinterest contains a smorgasbord of s'mores boards with pretty rows of graham crackers, marshmallows, and exotic flavors of chocolate bars, plus peanut butter cups, cookies, berries, peanut butter jam, and hazelnut spread. Chefs and culinary entrepreneurs are making s'more statements, too. Artisan s'more company S'morology, launched in West Covina, California, ships gourmet kits all over the country. And in Indianapolis, a startup called S'moresicles makes small batches of frozen s'mores on sticks and delivers them via a teal tricycle they call the S'morecycle. As variations on the toasted trifecta make their rounds this summer, you may get the feeling, that warm, toasty feeling, that if you're willing to snag the supplies and stoke a fire, you can always count on the classic. Department of Wit, a race well limped, a reluctant runner's key to keeping high spirits, low expectations, by James Breakwell, and this is from Exploding Unicorn. I'm walking around the house with a severe limp and actively second-guessing every decision I've ever made. That can only mean one thing. I just ran my one race for the year. For the second time in a row, my 13-year-old Betsy accompanied me on this foolish endeavor because the best mistakes are made in tandem. We both went into the 7-mile course with no training, and it showed. Determination and a can-do attitude are no match for gravity and distance. As an extremely sedentary person, it's important for me to occasionally do something semi-athletic, to remember that it's much better not to move. I'm greatly envious of those coral reef creatures that sit on one spot their entire life while plankton filters through their mouth holes. Betsy and I were accompanied to the race by a group of 3 extremely in-shape people. You wouldn't think that such individuals would want to associate with me, but we all live in the same Indianapolis suburb. I was the leader of our expedition because I told everyone about the race. And also, I own a minivan. The race is in my hometown in Illinois, and I've been doing it almost every year since I was Betsy's age. I peaked about 15 years ago and have been phoning it in with performance of various levels of ineptitude ever since. Why do I keep doing it if I no longer enjoy it and am getting worse every year? Tradition, mostly. Besides, I don't dislike the whole race, just the running part. I like seeing all the running club members I've known since childhood, and I love the free beer afterward. Running is just a minor stumbling block on the way to the good stuff. Betsy was a trooper. She finished the race for the 2nd year in a row. She's not a huge fan of the running part either, but she likes the adventure of going places with me and hanging out. As for how I ran, I did better than I thought I would. I was actually having a strong race through most of the course. Between mile 4 and 5, I felt so good that I wondered why I only do this race once a year. Then I hit mile 6, and my body reminded me. The human form is like a convoy of ships. It can only go as fast as its slowest part. Usually the lagging component is my breathing. I simply can't guzzle enough oxygen to get my awkward, unwielding body to go. This time it was my legs. I pushed until I had a mile left, at which point my quads and hamstrings decided they were done. Still, I can honestly say I gave everything I had. My slow, plodding finish was actually a victory shuffle that proves I gave it my all. I don't need a huge trophy to commemorate my heroic performance. My grossly swollen knee is enough of a souvenir. As I slowly made my way to the finish line, I had no idea how the rest of the group placed. I thought it would be funny if my friends came in first, second, and third, and people got the impression that our nondescript suburb was somehow a running powerhouse. They actually finished between 4th and 12th. Our fastest guy kept 5 minutes off his run from last year, yet there were still 3 people ahead of him. He didn't get a medal, but he did come away with an even better trophy, a massive, authentic, made-in-Japan German beer stein I picked up from a secondhand store years ago. It's basically our group's most improved award. I took it home last year because it's not hard to get better from rock bottom. When I passed the stein on to its new owner, I was supposed to fill it with beer and present it on one knee. Our top guy doesn't drink beer, which definitely has nothing to do with why he's so fast. So I gave him the beer stein full of diet soda instead. A day later, even as my entire body tells me I'm an idiot, I can't help but feel that the race was a success. Everyone in our group wants to do it next year. I'll keep doing this race for as long as my legs can support me. I proved I can still roll out of bed and run 7 miles, even if those 7 miles will prevent me from getting out of bed for all the days thereafter. Well, we're almost out of time, but before I go, I'll leave you with these patriotic 4th of July quotes for America's 250th. From John Philip Sousa, the red, white, and starry blue is freedom's shield and hope. And from John Adams, it ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations, from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward, evermore. Well, that does it for our program today. You've been listening to Articles and Stories from Reader's Digest. This program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org. Or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. This is Holly Miller, and I'll be with you again soon. Thanks for listening.
This is Bird Note. Bird voices can vary tremendously. When you're learning to recognize birds by ear, it can help to have shared vocabulary to describe how they sound. For example, some birds have clear singing voices, like this American robin. The scarlet tanager's song holds a similar tune, but this bird sounds a little hoarse. The word nasal comes to mind when describing the call of a red-breasted nuthatch. While the brown-headed nuthatch comes off as squeaky. Other birds are so buzzy that they're easily mistaken for insects, like this grasshopper sparrow. Some birds sound almost mechanical, like the metallic song of the common grackle, and the simple clicking notes of a yellow rail. Then there are aficionados like song sparrows that mix and match tones in complex compositions. Learning to describe bird sounds will make it easier to figure out who's singing and to remember the voices of your favorite birds. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Welcome to Everyday Poems for Every Day, sponsored by Audio Journal. Our poem today is The End by A.A. Milne. When I was one, I had just begun. When I was two, I was nearly new. When I was three, I was hardly me. When I was four, I was not much more. When I was five, I was just alive. But now I am six. I'm as clever as clever. So I think I'll be six now, forever and ever. You've been listening to Everyday Poems for Every Day, sponsored by Audio Journal and read by me, Nikki Whichelow. Thanks for listening. May your life be filled with poetic wonder.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.